I'll write it and we'll do it live.
The music, I guess, it starts my feet tapping and I get all happy inside.
You will not laugh. You will not cry. You will learn by the numbers. I will teach you.
Would you stop with the damn drumming?
You ain't got no problem, Jules. And wait for the wolf, which should be coming directly.
You sending the wolf?
I'm just having a time. Having a time.
I want all of you to enjoy your cake. So, enjoy.
Drums. I don't like the sound of those drums. An Indian hollered back, he ain't our regular drummer.
Welcome back to a very special edition of the Drummer's Weekly Groovecast. We have a very special return guest in the house. Groovecasters, please welcome back Mr. Ted McKenzie. Ted.
How do you do?
I'm doing good, man. Thanks for agreeing to be a part of this illustrious panel. We are back for Season 2's version of the Advisory Board. This is your first time doing this, but man, you're going to fit in right in lockstep with everyone.
Well, it's going to be a real experience I'm looking forward to.
Well, you're going to be on an illustrious panel. Go ahead and introduce our remote guests that we have this time. We've got a couple of newcomers, and we got a couple of return guests. We've got Joel Rosenblatt, who was on the previous advisory board show, along with Tom Breckline. And then new to the advisory board, we have Rod Morgenstein and Chris Fryer. So it's going to be a good time, man. We've got some really good, strong answers for our question, which we'll introduce here in a little while. But thanks for coming out, man. What have you been up to over the past couple months?
Well, just getting the family together for Thanksgiving, which is, you know, we've got 9 grandchildren and 1 on the way.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, trying to get all that going. That's you know, I'm kind of retired here. I have a few students I've been taking care of.
Yeah.
And just enjoying the Southern hospitality.
Man, speaking of students, I want to be the first one to thank you profusely for putting me in touch with Mr. Jason Bittner, who, as everyone is aware of, was our guest last week on the show. He was something else, man. What a storyteller that guy was.
He's an amazing man. He had a great student and wonderful drummer.
I'm telling you, he's got a lot of musical depth that I don't think is present in a lot of hard rock and metal drummers. And we actually covered that a little bit on the show. We talked about that there's a certain type of roots and a certain type of depth that's present in a lot of East Coast hard rock and metal drummers, and he certainly fits that bill.
Yes.
And part of it, and thanks to you, he talks a little bit about his time of studying with you.
Yeah, we had an interesting time. He was having a hard time adjusting from too much energy put onto the drum. And it's hard to understand until you figure out that you don't have to hit so hard. And hitting so hard, the drummers experience all sorts of injuries, and he was going through that. And I had the honor to you know, present to him what to do. And he was vigilant on that. He went after it, and I told him it, you know, probably take a couple of years, and it was about that, and took those gloves off that would protect him from getting torn up in his flesh, hitting the drums too hard. Took them off and presented himself. I watched him in a clinic for Zildjian play for 45 minutes straight, and he was all relaxed and flowing, and I like to think I had something to do with that. And
I know you did, because I was just going to mention exactly what you said, is that I saw a couple of recent videos of him, one playing with Overkill where he had like a live drum cam isolated on him, and it was so relaxed. You could tell he was hitting hard for sure, but proper technique, very relaxed. The entire thing just flowed when he played. And then also, we discussed at the beginning of his interview that he had just completed a clinic outside of his hometown around Schenectady, Albany area up there, that a video popped up of that clinic. And again, same thing. He was doing some demos with some tracks, did a little bit of soloing. So effortless in his playing. You could tell he was not over-hitting. He wasn't hitting through the drum, so to speak. He was playing with just very good, relaxed technique. And it certainly sounded that way as well as looking that way. So it was good stuff for sure.
I had the chance to help him with all that right at the precipice of him coming to the forefront of being labeled the number one metal drummer. And he presented himself that he was, to me, that he more than likely would have to stop playing. So, you know, I'm all you guys out there, if you're hitting too hard, you have to do a turnaround.
Yeah, and he has stayed very vigilant with his practice. You know, he almost every day, it's my understanding, has a couple hours of practice. And to use his exact verbiage from that past show, I do what has to be done during that 2 hours.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's practicing for a session, practicing for an upcoming clinic, maybe doing something for an upcoming tour, he just gets it done during that time. And he even mentioned that he still goes through different methods from time to time when he doesn't have something that's immediately pressing that he's working on. So thanks again, man, for bringing that
up. Well, thanks for bringing that up. That's quite an honor for me to say that I helped him out.
Oh, absolutely. And he holds you in extremely high regard, even after all the damage you did to him, Ted. he said, be looking for an email from him.
Oh, sweet.
He's going to reach out. I'm sure also that his band Overkill is going to be doing a North American tour in support of this new album that's coming out in February.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to hook it up. We're going to go down and have Groovecast lunch with him somewhere.
Oh, that'd be fun. Huh?
That'll be a good time for sure. Yeah. So, Ted, as we mentioned, today we are here. We are convening the Drummers Weekly Groovecast Advisory Board. It's one of my favorite things to do, even though this is only the second time it's been done. I really like doing it because the board members are incredibly eager and anxious to do it as well. I don't have to twist any arms, yourself included. You're so eager to do this that anytime I mention that I'm putting this show together, everybody's like, you just tell me when and where and what I need to be prepared to answer, and I'm going to do it. So for anyone who hasn't heard the previous advisory board show, here's basically the way that it goes. We have reached out to past guests, and we ask them one particular question. And essentially, we have them answer that question. If they're remote, such as Breckline, Rosenblatt, Fryer, Morgenstein, we record their answer. Ted and I will listen to it, and we will elaborate a little bit afterward. In studio here, Ted and I are going to give our own answers, and we will, of course, elaborate on each other's answers as well. And that's what it is. So it's basically a question that seems to either pop up very often in our own teaching practice or something that we know that's an issue, and we ask these folks to weigh in on it. And so the question this time around is essentially this. What important aspect do you believe is missing or should be done better in music education? And so, Ted, I'm going to go ahead and go first with my answer. You can remark on that, and then we'll go with your answer, then we'll listen to our remote answers.
Okay.
And so what I believe should be done better is a very direct, applied style of learning. It's not necessarily a concept, it's not necessarily a method, but it's something that I think is incredibly important because I deal with it on a absolutely a weekly basis, if a lot of times not even a daily basis. And that is, I have students that come to me regularly that need help working with electronically generated timekeeping devices. Now, you can consider that a click track, a sequence, a loop, a tempo track, whatever it is. But this is something that in my real world weekly or daily performance experience, I play with these things 80% of the time. And I was shocked, Ted, that even some of the most progressive schools of music don't regularly have students work with that. And I want to elaborate and tell you what I think in a perfect world scenario should happen. Of course, I think that students should be using these regularly in applied lessons, right? Whether it's applied drum set lessons or applied percussion lessons. They need to be taught, of course, how to play correctly with a metronome. They also need to be taught how you can program and manipulate a metronome. I think also, especially in drum set lessons, a good teacher should show these students how to play with and program sequences, mm-hmm. how to manipulate sequences. That's incredibly important, man. I do that all the time. And outside of applied lessons, I think that there should be classes, whether it be these, we'll call them RecTech or recording technology style classes. I know that that's covered somewhat in those classes, but it's at a point now to where there are certain styles of hardware and or software that are so ubiquitous in normal playing situations that those different pieces of hardware and software need to be taught regularly. And these hardware and software I'm talking about are programs like Pro Tools, Ableton Live, that sort of thing. Those things need to be taught because I think in the past, there was one of two things that happened. You either had teachers that were either unfamiliar with those programs and with that style of playing, or possibly were, we'll call them blissfully blind. You know, in other words, they're maybe stuck in their own way and like, this is the way I've been doing it for years and it's worked, so I'm just going to keep doing it. I think that's one scenario of where that there were some issues. And the other scenario is that I think there's just been a lack of willingness to integrate this stuff into different classwork that has been established for years. That's kind of the same way in some ways with the applied lesson, but in a classroom situation, I think that there's just been a little bit of hard-headedness with that. And at this stage of the game, especially if you're going to a major music school, these schools are in so many ways complicit in, we'll call it, educational malpractice. Because you have to be willing to do that and teach these students this because they're coming to me. You know, they're paying tens of thousands of dollars to, in some cases, to go to these schools, mm-hmm. and it's not happening. And so that's my thing, is that this performance, not just in the studio, but live performance on the fly with electronically generated timekeeping devices, it has to be taught, and it has to be taught significantly more comprehensively than it is. So there's mine.
I have a loaded question asked about that. Mm-hmm. You're talking about the number of programs that are available in this platform. How many are there?
There are quite a few, but the main thing is that there's only two or three that are prevalent, that are commonly used. And those are the main ones that I'm talking about. And granted, Ted, the savvy instructor will have to keep up with technology as it moves forward, because, for example, the two big ones I was talking about, Pro Tools and Ableton Live, in 10 years, they may not be the big boys on the block. Mm-hmm. But I just know that from my experience right now, whenever I'm working with sequences, it's generally with those two.
Mm-hmm. And how many of the colleges do you think are savvy with those two programs?
And that teach them the way that that I would say that they should be taught.
Yeah,
I'd have to give you percentages on that, and I'd say probably 5 to 10%. Mm. It's not good.
Yeah. Of course, when I was involved back in the '60s, there's none of that going on at all.
Yeah,
it hadn't been around. You'd get a wind-up metronome.
the old Franz analog.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, so I, as I told you, I'd been in contact with a couple of my former students who recently graduated, and one of them in particular, Zach Zacco from Berkeley, he was complaining about that same issue you just mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of my, I'd call him my star student, graduated from Berkeley, and he's the one that really opened my eyes to that issue as well, because I thought if there was any place in particular that would be on the cutting edge of that, that it might be Berkeley. Now, let me say this before I throw Berkeley under the bus, because, man, I've got a lot of good buddies, man, that teach up there. I'm not saying that all applied instructors are not teaching that. Mm-hmm. There very possibly could be some that are teaching that up there, but my students that have taken applied lessons up there didn't encounter those mm-hmm. people. And they even said that as well, that they had a feeling that there are certain ones that probably did teach that significantly more.
Mm-hmm. As I say, I'm coming from a very old school background, and I, as I already mentioned, I reached out to a couple of students, and it was interesting to me, and we had our little discussion before we got on, and it's a wide world of ongoing changes that mm-hmm. keep updating, and that's just an amazing thing to me. One thing I have done for my students is I've always involved them with a metronome
mm-hmm.
in everything they've done. So that is a little bit of, you know, foreplay and getting into college. That's where they choose to go. But, it's certainly a new world out there to me.
Well, I've mentioned it on the show before that I graduated from graduate school about 25 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had told me, and probably my professors also at that time,
mm-hmm.
that, hey, 15, 20 years in the future, 75%, 80% of the things that you actually play, not only in the studio, but live, are going to be done to some sort of a loop, click, sequence, tempo track, whatever, we would all said you're out of your mind.
That's right.
But it's here, man, and I don't see it going anywhere. Because like I had mentioned to you also begin before we started recording, is that there are times you think, well, there's going to be certain avenues or certain types of gigs that won't use them. I've been on big band gigs where we may not play directly to the click, but either the band leader or myself will have a metronome to count certain things off. And that was so foreign to me in prior experiences that it just didn't seem reasonable, but it's here.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it happens.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think even if you're integrated with that click experience in your daily practice, and you romance that thing all the time, what you're talking about, I mean, you would not be so disarmed mm-hmm. if you had to give a reference on a designated click per arrangement. I think that's perfectly safe. But getting into the big time programs, that seems to me like something that's really needed today.
Oh,
all the colleges.
It absolutely is. It's a must now. I mean, I think the practical application of this has gone from the point of being, oh, well, it's a luxury to teach it in classes, to where now, like I said before, it's pretty much educational malpractice if you're not. And you know, one other quick thing about this. There's a video, I've got it saved somewhere on my computer, where one of the most, I would call him old school traditional style teachers, has come to this realization and has basically said the same thing. It's Ed Sof. Mm. You know, Ed Sof recently retired from University of North Texas. Mm. But there's a video of him saying, now, today, you work on everything with a click. Everything, you practice it with a click, because it's just something that's ubiquitous. You have to be able to do it. So even Ed Sof, man, Ed Sof, he's all about that. So
yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah.
Wilcoxon. I put my kids to the Wilcoxon with a mm-hmm. click.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Ted, what else do you have over there? I know you did a basic focus group with some kids over there.
Yeah, geez, it was a lot of fun actually. Talk with Francesco Catricala, who I believe he recently graduated from SUNY College in New York, and he is talking about how to make money as a musician. Mm-hmm. He doesn't feel that that's been properly adjusted into his learning curve in college, and I relate to that even from way back in the 60s at Berkeley. You know, no one's going to tell you, hey, look, you're going to be a contractor and you need to get that under control. Here's what you do. Here's your ABCs. No, we never had anything like this, as far as I know. I mean, you got out of school and you hit the road, hopefully.
Right.
And or you have to conjure up the work. And, you know, that's just a huge curve of learning, as you know.
It's unbelievably difficult if you don't even have, if you're a student and you've never played gigs, and then all of a sudden you graduate. It is so unlike any other job. You're not going to all of a sudden start sending applications out, unless you're going for a teaching job. But yeah, for a straight up performing gig, there's a whole world of things you have to learn. And I'll tell you this, I was very, very fortunate that when I was in undergraduate school, I was shown some of the ropes from the standpoint of like being able to sub on certain teachers' gigs and say, look, you know, if you do this and if you do that, that's going to look good for you because this guy that's in this band works with this group and it could lead to this.
Networking.
Yeah. And you get your networking going and you get your relationships going. So I was taught from a pretty young age that this is how you can get your feet wet and start making some money doing this. So I was very, very fortunate from that standpoint. But you know though, Ted, let me say this. Being taught that was almost a subliminal thing. There was not a very pointed style conversation or much less any type of lesson and or class that talked about that.
Right.
But I will say this. One of the most valuable things that I remember from graduate school was there was an adjunct teacher that I helped coordinate the jazz combos with. I was a graduate assistant there. And we were talking one day, and he said, look, for our next combo class, because we would have a combo class, and then we would have everybody break off, and then you would end up doing your rehearsals at various times of the night. You would drop in and see these guys rehearse and help them with the different things they need to work on. Then you'd meet at that combo class on a Friday was what it was. Everybody kind of meet in the middle and discuss what they were doing. He said, you know, something that might be beneficial to everybody is, he goes, I'm a little bit of an expert on taxes for individual musicians, like independent contractors. And he goes, I think it might be interesting to spend one of those classes and talk to everybody about different things that are tax write-offs and different ways that you can, you know, work on your taxes to be advantageous. Because he says, well, I've learned throughout my years of being an independent contractor, you just don't generally take your taxes down to H&R Block because they're not familiar with this kind of stuff. You have right. to find somebody that's a specialist with musicians and entertainment, right?
Or marry a good woman.
There you go. Right. And that was something that I used that class, the information that he gave during that class. I used that thing. I still use it. Right. I do my own taxes.
Yeah.
I'm one of the few musicians that does their own. And I used that information and have since, you know, updated over all the years, all that stuff. But it was after you got through the first couple returns, it certainly helped out a lot. But yeah, that thing of hustling up gigs, I'm going to give you a little hint. We're going to hear that again in another answer. Yeah.
I could just give a little snippet of a taste of what I did getting out of college. Getting in a borrowed car, driving into New York City, actually storming in to the offices of all your major labels, saying, here's a product. We'd like you to hear it.
Yeah.
And if they did not receive it, we'd work our way around the secretary and get into the office. And that is just like, you know, Days of the Round Table, Knights of the Round Table. I mean, that just doesn't happen anymore, you know. And to get in, get your product in to, you know, to be looked at. I mean, it's no small task.
No, it's not. And these days, you would have to probably make a splash on social media before anybody would even look at you from the business end of things. Ted, you want to give a listen to one of our remote guests?
Absolutely.
Well, I want to preface this first one by saying that this gentleman that we're going to listen to first, he is bucking for chairman of the advisory board. This guy's an overachiever in every definition of the word, and that's Joel Rosenblatt. Joel, I contacted him a couple of weeks ago, and he's like, of course I'm going to do this. And I said, well, man, I appreciate you doing it. And then through various emails and text messages, he goes, I'm sending you a video. I'm like, what are you talking about? He goes, I'm sending you a video. I conducted a focus group. What he did, and you'll hear him refer to it a little bit in his answer, was he was able to speak to a group of half a dozen kids that were involved in various music departments. And he recorded their answers, and he wanted me to see the different answers that he was getting from these students. And then he basically formulated his answer from that little focus group.
Excellent.
So let's give a listen to the chairman of the advisory board, Joel Rosenblatt. Here we go.
The biggest thing is accountability. I mean, I think kids really want to be held responsible. And when the leadership is lacking, they're not, there's no expectations or there's no reward for doing the work, you know, like the person who's just phoning it in gets the same recognition or the same perks as a person who's really gone home and worked hard to try and improve themselves. And there's no payoff. And you know, that should come internally, but still, when you're a young kid, a little external praise, I think, helps. So accountability, consistency was another thing that kids were talking about. Because I'm not in the program, so I don't know what. In fact, if you look at what I told you, the girl was talking about consistency. Maybe you can take a listen to what she said. Time. I think I started to say before we were going to record, I said this school I mentioned that I mentor at, I went down specially because they had an entire high school band come to the school to check it out. And I went down there, we worked on a tune for a little while, and I was talking to the band director, and she said, you know, my jazz band time budget is 35 minutes from 7:25 a.m. to 8 a.m. 2 days a week. What the hell can you do in that time? And, you know, 10 minutes before everybody settles down, you have 15 minutes to work on shit. And then it blows my mind. You know, it, to me, it's like the schools are just phoning it in. Not all of them. I mean, it's so hard to generalize, but I mean, all I can do is compare to my experience, which was very immersive and very, I mean, I was, if I didn't do my work, I was afraid of, I knew people would know about it. My band director would call me out on it. The people that did do the work would feel me slowing them down or bogging them down. And there was like a little bit of pride. It's like, I'm on the team, you know? And again, we go back to the trophy thing. It's like kids who do subpar work are treated the same as kids who do amazing work. And that's a bad life lesson there.
Pretty good words from a fantastic, very accomplished drummer.
Yeah, what's going on there? That's frightening to me.
It's that weird accountability and that awful example of equity of outcome as opposed to equality of opportunity, which everybody's about equality of opportunity.
Sure.
But that equity of outcome thing is catastrophically bad.
It doesn't work in music.
It doesn't work in life, Ted.
Yeah, period.
Yeah. But I thought it was very illuminating that he hit upon that, because that's something that I think a lot of us are aware of in some ways.
Yeah.
But he's showing some real world examples of it by having those kids in that focus group, so to speak, talk about it.
Yeah.
And that thing, how about that thing about the lack of time also? 35 minutes, 2 days a week to rehearse a 17-piece band. You especially for kids where you're trying to actually teach them something.
Yeah.
That's nearly impossible. It's hard enough if you had 17 professional musicians in there and you're trying to go through That's charts right. and trying to clean things up, but much less a bunch of 20-year-olds.
Yeah. It's frightening to me.
That's tough stuff, man. But I think it needed to be said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, didn't mean to bring it down there, but man, that's some reality for you.
Well, yeah, that's I can't imagine that. That just makes my head blow up.
Yeah. But it's unfortunately prevalent, I think, in a lot of college situations. And I've got, and you do too, friends that teach on that level. And I've even had one friend say that they feel like that colleges are going to do themselves in.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's never been a time when you've paid more and gotten less in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I mean,
it's not a good combo.
I so relate to it on my experience of being in college and thinking, well, maybe I don't want to do X, Y, Z, and maybe I'd be better off studying privately mm-hmm. and get right to the source, right to the core. I wanted to get out and play, you know, and yeah. Well, I mean, you're the perfect go-to guy for that, with today's work. Perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, well, good answer from our newly crowned chairman of the board. Ted, this next answer is from a newcomer to the board. He is the drummer for the Zach Brown Band, and that's Mr. Chris Fryer. And Chris is another one of these guys that I reached out to, and immediately he was like 100%. He said, let me have a day or two to think about this. And then he said, we'll meet up and we'll get this answer recorded. And, you know, Chris has arguably got one of, if not the most high-profile gigs in the world right now. I mean, Zach Brown Band is one of the most popular bands in the world, and he's had his fair amount of educational expertise also. He went to University of North Texas, and also, here's a little trivia for you. He went to the University of Mississippi College for Women.
How's that?
That's the first thing I said to him also. I said, how did you manage that? And it's not a female-only college.
Obviously.
It's just the name of it.
Yeah.
So, let's give a listen and see what Chris Fryer had to say.
I think it's safe to say that a lot of the basics are covered. And I have given this a good bit of thought. A lot of the basics are covered in terms of learning to read, because there are plenty of opportunities for reading. It's a very important skill. I think stylistic studies and interpretation, that's already being covered. And the one thing that I think... You know, there are two things I have, but one more important than the other. And that is, no one teaches young drummers how to get out and hustle work. And hustling some work in the right way is what keeps your bills paid, keeps the lights on, and, you know, keeps you buying drum heads and drumsticks and all of that stuff. And the unfortunate side of this equation is that there is no real good answer for that, you know, for that problem, as I see it. You know, it's one of those things you just have to get out there. You have to, you know, there are a few things that work really well, better than others, you know, go to jam sessions, you know, meet people face to face, jam with people face to face, you know, sitting in your basement. And making YouTube videos won't necessarily get you the gig, you know. It's those spur of the moment musical, like I call them happy accidents, you know. It's those things that we encounter during an improvisational jam session that make the biggest impact. That's when somebody turns around and says, wow, I really dig the way he plays. I really dig the way that person, you know, covered up that gigantic train wreck in the jam session. That, you know, that drummer held it together, or that bass player really held it together. And, you know, because you can learn chops, you can learn grooves, you can learn how to interpret different things, you can learn to read. But learning how to get out and hustle work, that's a skill. And it's not, as far as I know, it's not taught. And I had to figure it out on my own at an early age. A lot of guys have to figure it out. You know, you Forrest Gump your way into a really big gig every now and again. And the truth of the matter is, if that gig ever comes screeching to a halt, then you're back out on the street, and you have to hustle. You got to get those skills back in shape, you know?
So, Ted, it sounds like there's a little parallel thinking between Chris and one of your contacts that you had there about hustling up work.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I gotta want to move on to another one of my students, Matt Nabowski. Went to William Patterson, New Jersey, college there.
Good school.
Yeah, and he had the benefit of working with teachers who were on the scene in New York City, so he could go into the city, watch them, he could sub for them, etc. And I think unless you're in a music college that, you know, to get into music college, I think you should be in one of those major cities, you know, Nashville, Boston, L.A., New York, and the others you might think of, and get on to getting on the scene, mm-hmm. and finding out from the pros and subbing for them, and you know, lapping up the gig when you can get it, and all those great things. I mean, how else are you going to do it? I've often told my students, and I think it still stands today, you're going to be in college, you'll get out of college, and then you start. It's not going to start in college. You're going to get a little prep there, but you're going to learn when you get out and hit the road running.
That concept of establishing yourself in a city, or in, let's just say, a major music market, mm-hmm. while you're in college, I've told students that you're kind of getting some time there for free, so to speak.
Right.
And I mean that in a very kind of a metaphorical kind of way. Of course, you're paying to go to college, you're paying to live there, mm-hmm. but at least the thing is, you have a purpose of being there instead of just kind of relocating to this enormously large city with having no contacts and just your dream, so to speak.
Right.
So yeah, if you can get yourself in one of those cities, mm-hmm. establish yourself from the standpoint of like, I'm here to actually play, but I'm going to school to learn this craft.
Right.
That's a major boon. Really is.
Absolutely.
It's funny, isn't it, man, that Chris Fryer hit on the exact same thing.
Yeah.
That's obviously an issue that needs addressing.
Yeah. I think that's been an ongoing issue forever.
Yeah.
Quite frankly.
Yeah. Now, our next guest is another newcomer. It's Rod Morgenstein. He gave us a great interview back in the summer. And I want to preface this by saying that Rod's answer is a tad bit longer than the others, but there's a very good reason why. And Rod's answer has to do with some anecdotal evidence or anecdotal stories. And it'll make a little more sense after you hear this entire thing. But he has to explain the story. He has to explain the anecdote, so that it makes sense. So let's give a listen to retired Berkeley professor, also, by the way, Rod Morgenstein.
I can't wait.
Right. Okay. So like when I had responded to your email, I had kind of said, you know, in all honesty, I'm not fully aware of what other music colleges and schools and teaching institutions curriculums are. But just speaking from my own experience of, you know, having taught at Berkeley for the past 20 years, from the get-go, I thought it would be really important from my view of things to bring my real-life experience to the teaching process, because I think what better way for a student to kind of pick up some important tips than from someone who actually lives the life. Now, That said, I think it's incredibly important and worthwhile for students of music to study out of various teaching methods, you know, drum books. And in fact, you know, I have my own drum books that I've written through the years and that I've used with most of my students. But I think in the end, a drum book doesn't tell the entire story, because the drum book itself doesn't live the life out there in the real world on the road. And so there's lots of things that musicians learn when they leave the classroom or their music room or their drum room, when they actually get out there and start interacting with other musicians and people who are part of the music business. And so I always like to relate anecdotal stories to my students that I think are worthwhile and can help them, you know, in their journey towards hopefully having a nice career in music. So early on in my career, when the Dixie Dregs got a record deal, when we went into the studio with our second, for our second record, we had the honor of getting to work with Ken Scott, who was one of the high profile engineer and producers in the 70s. And so we were thrilled to get to work with him. Now, at the time, we were 23 years old. He had been around the block for 20 some odd years. But when you're young, you kind of think you know everything. And so here we were in L.A. You know, we flew from Atlanta, Georgia, or Augusta, Georgia, wherever we were living, to L.A. We're in the studio. And I remember 30 seconds into playing the very first song for him, because he wanted to hear the music before we actually went into the studio, he stopped the band from playing and spent the next half hour just tearing my drumming apart. In a constructive way, but I was very upset because he obviously was not happy with all the things I was doing. And so in the end, he probably had me simplify my performance. From every 10 notes that I was playing, I ended up playing one. So I hated his guts in that particular moment. And he kept asking me to hit the drums harder. And so in hitting the drums harder, he was trying to explain, you get a better signal into the microphone, and so your drums will have a nicer sound, a bigger sound. And as far as simplifying everything that I was doing, he was trying to explain that when you make records and you record your instrument for the song, it's not about you trying to throw in all your coolest licks. It's about playing the right part for the song that you're playing. So he said, stop being so concerned with just what you're doing and try to think big picture and play for the song. All right. So that was, you know, one particular thing that when I finally, you know, was able to get outside of my ego a little bit, I came to understand through the years that what he was teaching me was a very important lesson. So going back to books, if you learn some really cool, intricate patterns in books, don't just assume that you can now apply this pattern to the next piece of music that you're learning when you record it.
Pretty good advice to get from an applied teacher, isn't it?
Yeah, I so relate to that.
Yeah, I mean, when you are in any type of a performance style class or applied lesson, the ability to get real world, been there, done that advice is so incredibly important.
It's priceless.
It's absolutely priceless because, again, not to reiterate or go directly over what he said, but you know, the techniques and the methods that you learn are fantastic, but then being able to use them in a real practical situation,
yeah,
and make it work. That's the real deal there.
That's right. This discernment.
Yeah.
Yeah. An application to the each style and individual application to the arrangement. Oh my gosh. How do you learn that at music college? I mean, I would say a small fraction of the college going group of musicians will learn it before they get there a little bit, but until you hit the road with the big boys, you've got that curve to go through.
Mm-hmm.
I truly believe that.
Yeah. Having somebody like Rod Morgenstern at least get you in the ballpark.
Yeah.
He's going to be able to supply a certain amount of experience that 95% of other teachers are not going to be able to supply.
Exactly.
And
right.
So, boy, there's an intangible that if you can get that in your lessons, man, that you're going to be well ahead of the curve for sure.
Absolutely.
I want to go ahead and say this also, that response was about 5 minutes long. When Rod and I talked, we recorded nearly half an hour of stuff. I'm in the other 20 to 25 minutes of his answer it's equally fantastic, because there's another couple of great anecdotal stories of him doing different gigs and or recording sessions that are equally applicable. I'm almost thinking about trying to figure out a way to put that in somewhere as well, because it's good stuff. It's really solid stuff.
Invite him in and expound on all that. It would be priceless.
Yeah, it's good stuff. And it's varied styles of music, too. In other words, there's one of the stories he talks about doing a recording session with Winger and a producer that was one of Mutt Lange's proteges, about how they went about recording that. It's really, really good stuff. Just didn't have quite enough time to include it in this show. So, Ted, our last panelist, remote panelist that we're going to listen to today, is a return guest. It's Tom Breckline. Tom's another one of these guys that anytime I ask him if he wants to be a part of something, he just jumps at it immediately. Love Tom. And Tom's answer was pretty long as well. Ended up cutting it down just a tad bit. But Tom is one of these guys that's 50-something years old with 150 years of experience. And so he jumped at the opportunity to answer this question. And a lot of his focus is on application of material that you learned in a real world setting. So let's give a listen and see what Tommy has to say.
Well, like I said, we'll just hip the student to applying what you're teaching him to going out there and creating yourself, you know, or taking stuff off of a record, you know. It seems like the guys, and I had this discussion with a student the other night, and I said, I can only give you what's conceptual about, I mean, well, little exercises that'll lead towards you listening to what's happening on the record and you figuring it out, you know, which you can either transcribe it or you could learn it by ear, which is kind of cool because, well, either transcribing, well, you're learning by ear when you transcribe it, but it's just, but it's your take on what's being played. It could be exactly what's being played or not exactly what's being played. And that's where you go off and you make that thing your own. You know, like when we were kids, you know, you get Advanced Techniques for the Modern Drummer, and then you get the Joe Quesada's book, and then maybe the Bible on Rock and Roll Drumming, or you know, Joel Rothman's thing, and then all the snare drum stuff, it's your own book and all that. And combine it with even what you've read in those books or those concepts, or whatever other books that led towards basics on the drum set, you know, you go out and you learn it. We'd learn it on our own, you know. For instance, like with Tower of Power, you know, Dave Garibaldi, I go, what's he doing? So you'd struggle with it, you know. What's Tony Williams doing? How's he getting that thing with the right hand? It's like I sound like, well, I am an old man, but I don't feel old. But it's like, you know, what's he doing? You know, I mean, there were no complete transcriptions on that. So you'd sit and you'd struggle with it and you'd get it. And through that, you'd get the feel of the thing. And you'd be learning mechanics for other stuff. You know what I mean? By just doing that, you're kind of exercising other musical things and physical things without really knowing it. My first teacher, John O'Reilly, taught me with these basic books. You know, with learning snare drum, knowing that, you know, and just you have the tools there. Now you do put it together and do it. And then when we were kids too, it's like it would actually distract us from, at least me, from actually practicing the actual lesson, because I'd go out and with what I learned from the lesson and try and figure out what these guys were doing on record.
Essentially, Tom and I ended up talking afterward about there seems to be a little bit of a lack of curiosity on many students' part today. And
I agree.
Yeah. The thing that I think that gets lost in translation sometimes is even when you show a student a method and then you show them in certain ways, this is how this is applicable to a real world playing setting. I think there are too many times that students want you to show them by rote exactly this is where this is used and how it's done. And it's not necessarily that easy. You don't want to force something into a playing setting. And there comes that spirit of investigation that's on the student's part. And I think that's what Tommy was saying at the end also. Look, here's the lesson. I'm giving you the tools, and this is where a general setting of where it would be used. Now it's up to you to figure out, using your own personal musicality, how it's going to work for you in that setting. So here's the application, but here's the general application. I can't give you the exact specific ways you're going to use this, but this is where it's most likely going to happen. And it's up to you, student, to use your curiosity and make it happen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I totally agree. I think there's a huge lack of curiosity on the behalf, and unknown to a lot of drummers. One of my questions would be to a student, who are your heroes? And a lot of them can't come up with more than a name or two. Mm-hmm. I was watching Tony Williams the other day in a clinic, and one of the questions was, what are you thinking of when you're playing up there? What do you what's going through your mind? He said, well, I'm simply playing everything I've ever heard any of my heroes play, which was astonishing to me. I mean, he's being very transparent at that point and saying that I'm just exuding what I've heard. And isn't that what we all do, from, you know, taking up the alphabet to hearing the phrases in the house, and then eventually making them your own, you know? And no matter who you listen to, really, after a while, you are your own person. And I think you have to identify with that as well. You have to come into your realm and understand that this is how you're going to deal with it. And try not to get into a fantasy world of I am this and I am that. No, you are you. And, you know, to be given that chance, one of my students was talking about this. And I think it's so important that you need to have history and you have to draw it in and you have to try to replicate it. But after enough experience, it's going to be you, no one else. And then how did any of them get it? Same way.
Ted, I have my own ham-fisted philosophy on why there seems to be a lack of curiosity and spirit of investigation on modern students. And I'm not saying this is the only reason, but I think that there's something to do with this. And I'm going to give you a real-world example here. I feel like that in particular when students want to learn something now, it is so easy to go on YouTube or just do a Google search, find volumes of information, if not exact representations of what they want to learn, and this is exactly how you do it. So therefore, when you run into an issue and you have to learn something that's not on YouTube, that's not on a Google search, in other words, something that you have to dig into, it's kind of like, well, that's just too much. It's too much to do. And here's how I came up with this hypothesis, right? I had a student come in. He said, man, I got to show you something. And he handed me this transcription, beautifully transcribed, of a Tony Williams comping, like the ride pattern and comping behind, I think it was the live Four and More Seven Steps to Heaven, which is just burning, man, absolutely killing, right? And and think about it, it was behind like Miles's solo, which he took about 12 choruses. And so you sit here and think about this. This took this kid 6 months to get this because, you know, there's a lot of subtleties in that, man, a whole bunch of subtleties. And I'm like, man, congratulations. Where did you get this? He goes, some guy did this online and I downloaded it. And on top of that, there's a video of this guy. It's an Italian guy. I'll have to show you if you haven't seen this. There's a video of the guy recording himself playing it, and at the bottom of the screen in 4-bar chunks, it's going by him playing it at that blazing tempo. And so it's just readily available, so much stuff that you don't even really have to be curious past putting a search term inside of Google or YouTube, and most of the stuff will pop up. Somebody's found it. It's like, you mentioned the Wilcoxon book, right? That's one of our Bibles of drumming.
Sure.
Any serious student needs to be familiar with the Wilcoxon books. There's several of them, right?
Right.
But let's take, for example, the 150 solos, right? Ted, you can go online right now, and you can just put in a random number, Wilcoxon solo 46. And there will be five examples of it, of which two or three of them are burning really, really good. That didn't exist, man, you know, not that long ago. And there used to be so many weird, whacked out interpretations. People didn't know how these things were supposed to be phrased and how they were supposed to be interpreted. And now it's right there. I mean, there's good and bad to everything, right?
Right.
But that's just one quick example of that.
Yeah, you're so right. It's so readily available. Back in my day, it was a record player. Mm-hmm. Before that, what do? You march around and feed off your fellow drummers and hopefully someone who's in charge of the whole brigade, you know. But it's all come down to the same thing. It's just, I think the more you dig, the better it is. And I don't know.
Well, it'll certainly leave a more of a lasting impression on you.
Exactly.
Because one of the things that I've always been a major proponent of when it comes to transcriptions, which is one of the things that Tommy was talking about on here, is I've seen it happen too many times where guys, it doesn't matter what instrument it is, guys, girls will transcribe a solo, transcribe whatever it is, and they'll get it on paper first, that's okay, but then when it comes to the actual performance aspect of it, it's almost secondary. I came to the conclusion years ago that if I was going to transcribe a solo, if I was going to transcribe any type of a comping or a groove type exercise, that the first thing that I was going to do is I was going to learn it first,
right?
Then put it on paper,
right?
Because the other thing is this, is that if you learn it first, putting it down on paper is relatively just dictating it.
Right.
It's made more of an impression upon me by doing it that way.
Yeah, I think that's correct. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. The basic ear training. But that goes back to the hunger and the grabbing of it, you know, and just doing that and going after icons.
Yeah. There. getting into that blessing and a curse scenario again, I've got another student that went to another major music school, and he had access to a database of transcriptions that was amazing. I mean, absolutely amazing. It's one of those kind of things that you could think of all these great drum solos, great drum grooves, great drum breaks, fills, these different types of things. And you think, I wonder if they've got Garibaldi playing Ebony Jam. And all of a sudden you do a search and there it would be. Somebody had already transcribed it. You know, it's like, wow, I wonder if they've got the Philly Joe fours on Billy Boy. And all of a sudden, there it is, you know. So there's another one of those things that sometimes having that at your fingertips is actually detrimental.
I've looked at that, some of that stuff you're talking about, and there it is in front of you. And you can sit down and coldly put it out, but you got to listen to where it came from. It came from the heart. You can't replicate the heart. You have your own, and you got to interpret it. You know?
Yeah. Well, Ted, that seems like a pretty good place, man, to put a bow on this thing. I think that we got some great answers and got some interesting concepts and thoughts on that topic today.
Absolutely, and I certainly give you a big, you know, hurrah for thinking about this and putting it down. I mean, this is fantastic, man, that you're brilliant.
Oh, well, Ted, thanks, man. I really appreciate it. I just occasionally think that there are these different concepts and topics that need answers from time to time that have never really been fully addressed, and that if you can get a broad range of opinions on it, which I think we got some good answers. Some of them did overlap today.
Yes.
But I think that if you get some good answers from some highly respected, knowledgeable professionals, it's going to be beneficial to everybody.
Absolutely.
Ted, thanks for coming over, man. I really appreciate it. We will, in the next season, do another advisory board, have you come over here and be a part of that one.
I'll be here, Lord willing.
Yeah, man. To all the listeners, thanks so much. We appreciate your support and your listenership. We do this show for you. As always, if you haven't been over to our website, go over to drummersweeklygroovecast.com. There you can find everything you'd ever want to know about the show. You can listen to all of our episodes. We have some videos over there for you to check out. You can manage your social media subscriptions to the different platforms that we're on. And if you want to email us, there's an email form on there too. So feel free to drop us a line. Let us know what you think about the show. Let us know if you've got any things you want to add to this episode. And especially if you've got any questions. You know, we take time to answer all of the questions that come in. And occasionally we mention them on the show itself. And then we don't ask too much from you guys, but in particular, if you listen on the Apple platform through iTunes, do us a solid. And the next time you're in iTunes, swing by our homepage, the Drummer's Weekly Groovecast, and leave us a short review. It does us a world of good, because essentially what it does is it ranks us higher in the listings for people who are looking for shows that have our type of content, whether it be drumming or musical content, whatever it is. We'd greatly appreciate it if you'd stop by and do that. And you can always find us anywhere that you listen to podcasts, whether it be, of course, iTunes, Google Play Podcasts, Stitcher, Podbean, any place, SoundCloud, any place that hosts podcasts, you should be able to find us there. If you can't find us, you're either not looking hard enough or you don't want to find us. All right, Ted, that's going to do it for this week, man.
Great. Thanks so much, Phil.
You bet. Thanks, guys. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.